Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, making plastic from thin air, or at least from waste carbon dioxide. A moth that you can scoff, and that's an edible metal organic framework, not an insect that likes light bulbs. And bubble-powered micro-engines, how catalase can make these tiny jet engines faster and more efficient. Plus, the molecular receptors that help mosquitoes spot our distinctive aroma.
The types of compounds that we tend to emit are things like aromatic compounds, like indol, phenols. They smell kind of stinky. We work with them in the lab, and they do smell a lot like dirty gym socks or something like that. They're not pleasant to work with.
And we explore the catalytic capacity of gold nanoparticles. I'm Ben Valsler, and for this, the September edition of the Chemistry World Podcast, I'm joined by Nina Notman, Matt Wilkinson, and Mike Brown.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
To get us started this week, a new way to make plastic from pollution. Tell us more, Matt.
Yes, Ben. A US company called Novomer has been awarded an $18.4 million grant to turn thin air, or actually carbon dioxide, into plastics. And the type of plastic they're going to be turning them into is a type of polycarbonate polymer. And these are used to make all sorts of things, from plastic bottles, laminates that coat CDs, you name it, there's polycarbonate in them.
So how are they actually doing it?
Right, so what they do is they take a carbon dioxide stream from a waste source, from an industrial process. Then they use a cobalt catalyst that Novomer's chief executive, Jim Mahoney, describes as a relatively complicated but easy to handle cobalt catalyst. And these then react with CO2 and an epoxide molecule, and they form various lengths of polymer, and they can control the weight of the polymer formed by throwing in what they call a branching agent. So they can basically control the weights of the plastics, and therefore they can make them applicable to a whole range of applications, and incredible control over that molecular weight.
So this makes them an ideal sort of normal feedstock that can go into normal plastic production?
Absolutely. The plastics they actually make are already known from the petrochemical sources, and they can create them with maybe a little bit more control in some ways. And of course, rather than using oil, which is becoming increasingly expensive to use, they're using a waste product, which many countries are investing lots of money into figuring out ways to bury underground. This might make a lot more sense to actually, rather than bury it, turn it into something useful.
So it won't help to reduce our reliance on plastics, but it should help to reduce our reliance on the oil that we use to make them in the first place.
Definitely, yes. And it should also help to make plastic production far more environmentally friendly and sustainable.
Thanks, Matt. Mike, we've been looking at a new way of identifying the structures of chemicals as well this week.
Yeah, that's right. So a team of scientists at IBM in Switzerland, in collaboration with colleagues at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, have used a form of microscopy to image molecules to determine their structure. So in chemistry, especially with natural product synthesis, identifying structures is quite a problem. And traditional techniques such as nuclear magnetic resonance, which is NMR, sometimes has difficulty identifying structures. You can go so far with the techniques we've got, but you sometimes come out with possible structures, and you may have four possible structures. So it's a challenge to find out what the structure actually is. And the team at IBM have used atomic force microscopy, which is where there's an atomically sharp tip mounted on an oscillating spring. This moves near a molecule which is mounted on a surface. And when the tip becomes near the molecule, it changes the vibrating frequency that it's oscillating at. And this is called a detuning. And all these detunings, depending on what atom you're over, will cause a different vibration. And then these can be recorded and converted into dark and light areas and build up an image. So what the guys have been doing is building up this image. And from the image, they can see that two of the possible structures from the NMR spectrum are total rubbish. And then they've got two other structures which they can use calculations to prove which one is actually the correct structure.
So what chemical have they actually been looking at?
Okay, so they've been taking a natural product which the guys at the University of Aberdeen are interested in, which is called ceflanadol A. The reason they've been looking at this is because in the past, the reported structure has been found to be wrong.
As it's something that we didn't know the structure of and had these four options, how can we be certain that this technique actually works?
About a year ago, the guys at IBM used the technique to prove that it worked. They used pentosine, which is a known structure. It's a planar structure. And they successfully imaged pentosine. So we know from all the other analytical techniques that the structure determination using this method is correct. But now we're taking it a step further. Instead of proving structures that are already known, we're finding out structures that are unknown. So in reality, you could in the future use this technique in the pharmaceutical industry or, you know, in the lab in conjunction with NMR to actually prove unknown structures and speed up the process.
So vibrations on the molecular scale can help us to determine the exact structure of a whole host of unknown chemicals. Thanks, Mike. The structure of a molecule often dictates how it responds to other molecules, and so it can be very useful in understanding how biological systems will respond to a chemical stimulus. This is essential in understanding how biting insects, such as mosquitoes, will find their host and can lead to new and better ways to prevent bites and transmission of disease. I spoke to Dr. Alison Carey at Yale University.
So we've been looking at how mosquitoes smell. And in particular, we've been looking at the Anopheles gambiae species, which is the major vector of malaria in sub-Saharan Africa. And this species of mosquito, Anopheles gambiae, relies heavily on its sense of smell to find its human blood meal targets. So we've been looking at the molecular basis for this process.
So what is it in particular about the mosquitoes themselves that you're looking at? Are you dissecting mosquitoes to look at what's going on in their antennae?
We are. We're sort of doing that at a molecular level. We have looked at the odorant receptors. And so this is a big family of about 80 proteins. They're membrane receptors that bind to volatile chemicals. And this they've been identified first in the model organism Drosophila melanogaster about a decade ago now. And they were a little bit more recently identified in Anopheles gambiae, the genes were. And we set about to functionally characterize these odorant receptors.
So we're looking to find out what chemicals these receptors actually respond to. How specific are they?
So it varies. That's an interesting question. So we sort of systematically looked at as many of the receptors as we could. There are, as I mentioned, about 80 of them, and we were able to look at about 50 of them. For various technical reasons, we couldn't study all of them. And then we found that some of the receptors are not so specific. They'll bind to, of the 100 compounds we tested, they might be activated by 20 or 30 of them pretty strongly. And then we found some other receptors that are extremely specific, and they, out of the 100-plus compounds that we tested, might be activated by just two or three. And so we thought that was interesting, actually, that some of the receptors are sort of specialists and others are more generalists. And we also did notice that there's a continuum. It's not a division of just specialists and generalists, but there's sort of a continuum in what we call the tuning breath of the receptor.
Mosquito receptors are there to help guide the mosquito through its world, but it's not just mm-hmm. looking for animals to bite. It's also looking for
right.
mates and for right. sugar meals when they need them. How can we tell which are the important receptors with regards biting us?
At this stage in the research, we can't be certain which of the receptors that we've studied are for sure playing a role in guiding the mosquito to its human host. But there's a lot of literature out there about what sorts of chemicals humans release. So what comes off our skin from sweat, from bacterial breakdown products of sweat and skin. And there are many papers about that. And sort of the types of compounds that we tend to emit are things like aromatic compounds, like indole, phenols. They smell kind of stinky. We work with them in the lab, and they do smell a lot like dirty gym socks or something like that. They're not pleasant to work with. And things that come from plants, you know, there's also huge literature on the sorts of chemicals that plants and fruit would emit. And those tend to be things like esters and aldehydes and ketones. And again, if you open up a bottle of an ester, it smells very fruity. It smells like a banana or like an apple. So there, we do have information from other people's research about the types of chemicals generally that are emitted from people versus from plants. And certainly there's a lot of overlap between the two. There's no known human-specific odorant or no known plant-specific odorant, but more sort of general trends of the types of compounds that would be coming from different sources.
So can we start to look at the receptors, look at the chemicals that they're specific for, and work out which ones we need to target to try and reduce things like malarial transmission?
So that's the idea. So we feel that we've come up with some good targets because we've identified some receptors, particularly these specialist receptors that respond to compounds that have been identified as coming from human sweat or human emanations. And we think that these are really interesting potential targets as playing a role in the behavior of the mosquito. So the next step is to test this hypothesis behaviorally. And to do that, we are collaborating with a group that specializes in mosquito behavior. And they are right now testing some of the compounds that we've identified as activating these receptors to see if they can get an attractive behavior to these compounds. And then a next step after that might be to look for compounds that could inhibit the receptor responses and therefore might inhibit the behavioral response.
So what are our options for inhibiting this response? Do we need to block the receptor? Do we need to find another chemical that will deactivate the receptor?
That's a great question. So there are sort of a number of ways we could go about it. One idea is to find another chemical that blocks the response to the first chemical. And we've identified some candidates there, and we can try to test those. Another idea is, could we find a compound that sort of super activates the receptor, so it just sort of has a very sustained response, perhaps, and sort of jams the receptor? It's been shown in other insects that the temporal dynamics of an odorant receptor's response are important for guiding the animal, that it provides information about the odorant identity. And so if we can maybe disrupt the temporal dynamics of the response, that might be useful as a way to inhibit or repel the mosquito. It's also possible there's some evidence for repellent channels, so you might activate a neuron, and that neuron is, well, the receptor and the neuron is part of a repellent pathway. So activating doesn't always correlate with attraction. I mean, if you put your hand on a stove, you have, you know, receptors and neurons that are activated, certainly, but it's a negative response to that activation. So similarly, if we could identify some receptors that are part of a repellent pathway, could we find activators for those receptors? So I think there are a number of ways we could look for things that would be behaviorally active.
Yale University's Alison Carey on ways to interrupt a mosquito's sense of smell and so cut back on the burden of mosquito-borne diseases like malaria. Now, if all that talk of sweaty gym socks hasn't put you off your dinner, Nina has news of a new edible chemical structure.
Indeed we have. So this work, which has been done by Fraser Stoddart at Northwestern in the US, has been looking at MOFs, which are metal organic frameworks made from molecules which have been approved for human consumption. So these frameworks, which are networks of metal nodes connected by organic struts, have been considered for various applications such as storing gas or delivering drugs. And it's hoped that being able to make edible versions of these molecules might have applications in the food and pharma industry. So Fraser's team were actually intending to look at new interlocked molecular architectures, and falling upon this edible MOF was actually a bit of an accident. In the lab, they were taking the 8-membered sugar ring, gamma cyclodextrin, which is a low-cost derivative of starch, and dissolving it with potassium hydroxide, which is a salt substitute, in water. They then diffused ethanol through the system and found that they got well-defined colourless crystals. They then looked at the crystal using X-ray and found something quite unexpected, which was 6 cyclodextrin rings formed the faces of a cubic structure, and these cyclodextrin rings were held together using coordinating potassium ions with an open pore in the centre. They saw that these cubic structures, many of them fitted together to form a large 3D cubic framework, so the standard kind of framework of a MOF. They then looked at the possible uses of these moths. So, and one of the standard tests is to see how much nitrogen will stick into the pores. And they found that these edible moths absorb the same amount of nitrogen as many of the other moths which are out there. Apart from the fact that they're edible, another big advantage of these moths is that most of the ones which are available at the moment come from petrochemical feedstocks, where these are obviously a carbon-neutral source.
So much like making plastic from CO2, as we were talking about earlier, this would reduce our reliance on oil. I've heard of moths being put forward as things for carbon capture devices, but what could the pharmaceutical industry get out of them?
The pharmaceutical industry are very interested in controlled drug delivery, and the pores in the centre of these frameworks could be used to store the drugs, and then they would, presumably the moths would dissolve as they got to the right place in the body.
And the fact that they're edible compounds mean that we're not using something toxic to deliver something that should ideally be helping. Thank you very much. Going from inner space to outer space, we've found mysterious buckyballs floating around in between the stars. Tell me more.
Yes, Ben. Researchers led by Jim Kamey of the University of Western Ontario in Canada have discovered huge clouds of these buckyballs, which are 60 or 70 carbon atoms in spherical football-shaped structures. And it's a fascinating story about how they've actually discovered them. Many years ago, when Sir Harry Kroter and his team at the University of Sussex were looking for structures out in space, they came across these, what they believed to be carbonaceous compounds in between stars. But they never quite figured out exactly what they were. They then went into the laboratory and actually made these C60 molecules, and that ended up winning Sir Harry Kroter a Nobel Prize. But even once they had them and actually managed to fully characterise them, they've never been particularly identified out in space. People have guessed that the signals they've seen have possibly been due to these types of molecules, but they've never been able to get really conclusive proof. So what's happened now is that using the onboard infrared spectrometer on the Spitzer Space Telescope, they've focused in on a particular area of the universe. It's the planetary nebula TC1, which is about 6,000 light years away. And they've managed to find the four vibrational peaks that you would expect to find from the C60 Buckminster fullerene molecule. Why they haven't found those peaks in other places is probably due to the fact that these are all in from a nebula in material that's been blown off a star, so it's all still very, very hot, and so they're still emitting lots of radiation. Whereas if you look in the background of general space, the interstellar space, you know, the gap between the stars, that's all quite cold, and so they're not emitting very much radiation, which is why we can't see it, even though it's probably there. And what's amazing about these gas clouds is that they probably contain around 10 to the 23 kilograms of material, which is about enough to make a planet 1.5 times the size of the moon. So it's just a phenomenal amount of material in these big gas clouds.
So we've gone from not being able to find it but thinking it's there to finding quite an enormous amount of it just through the fact that it was quite warm. You said that we suspected it was there before and we saw hints. How can we be certain that this is definitely a signature of buckyballs?
Well, the fingerprint that you see in the infrared spectra is exactly the same as those that you would see if you heated up these molecules to the sorts of temperatures that they expect TC1 to be at. They're exactly replicated in the spectra that you would see on Earth.
Thanks, Matt. So at last we found buckyballs in space, and more than enough to make a full-size model of our own moon. You're listening to the Chemistry World podcast with me, Ben Valsler. Still to come, we've got more chemistry news and our side-splitting chemistry joke of the month. But now, nano-sized particles of gold are showing great promise in a number of applications, from production of hydrogen peroxide to selective oxidation of hydrocarbons. But gold itself has long been understood to be a very unreactive metal. Graham Hutchings, Professor of Physical Chemistry and Director of the Catalysis Institute at Cardiff University, explained why, for catalysts at least, people are going for gold.
Well, the appeal of gold as a catalyst is simply that there's a perception that gold would not be an active material. This has suddenly amazed people, and a number of people start to think that gold was not only going to be the best catalyst for carbon reactions, where it was shown to be by far the best catalyst. But it, in fact, could do everything. And so you'll find in the literature at the moment everybody trying gold for everything. But it's this appeal that it was something which is the most noble of metals. It's immutable. And therefore, why should it suddenly be one of the best catalysts? And so it's just caught everybody's imagination.
And so what do you have to do to take this very unreactive metal and cause it to be a catalyst?
That's the exciting bit. A lot of people will be familiar with the terms nanochemistry, but in reality, all chemistry is nano because it deals with things at the nanoscale. All molecules are effectively nanomaterials. And in this case, if you take gold and divide it down to a few atoms, then it takes on a very reactive character. And so in CO oxidation, people have considered that it's very, very small nanoparticles of gold which are the active species. Now, whether they're gold metal or they contain cationic or anionic species with them, the trend has been in people's minds is that the smaller the particle, the more active it is for a number of reactions. And this has been a trend in microscopy as well, in that as people have improved the microscopy now with something known as aberration-corrected scanning transmission electron microscopy, one can actually see single gold atoms against the right supporting matrix. We're now able to know that actually collections of 7 to 10 gold atoms are associated with very high activities for CO oxidation. And so that really is at the nanoscale. And people weren't able to pick this up before. And so until the 1980s, when it was shown by Masataki Iruta that small gold nanoparticles were very active for CO oxidation and it couldn't be pinned on impurities, it really was gold. And at the same time, when I showed that cationic gold was the best catalyst for acetylene hydrochlorination, then it became apparent that there really was something. And it wasn't just an artifact or impurities that were going on.
So why do we think it is that gold on the nanoscale should have this effect, but on the microscale loses it completely?
Well, this is probably to do with the electronic structure, and it's still a matter of controversy as to why this happens. So if you were to ask 10 scientists in the room that are active in gold, I'm sure you'll get 11 answers on this one. Basically, if you go down to below 2 nanometers for a particle of gold, so you've got a collection still of several hundred to 1,000 atoms at that level, you lose the band structure of the metal, i.e. the electrons are not moving in the way that they were, and so it loses its metallic structure. And so at that point, people associated large amounts of catalytic activity with it. I suspect that it's a mixture of electronic factors and also the interface with the support that one puts these nanoparticles on. So the supporting matrix, which could be an oxide or a carbon, makes a big impact on the catalysis that's observed. And so one has these sites at the interface between these nanoparticles and the oxide or the carbon support. And that changes the electronic nature because you've got the electrons coming from the support or going to the support as well. So if a long answer, it's a matter of immense controversy at the present time, and I'm certainly not going to put my head above the parapet.
Does the actual structure of these nanoparticles affect its properties as well? Does it matter what shape it is?
Yes, so that's a very good question indeed. When you've got something which is 7 to 10 atoms, then the materials are likely to be bilayers with perhaps 5 to 6 atoms on the bottom and 1 or 2 atoms on the top. The 5 or 6 atoms that are associated with the support have got a very strong interaction with that support, and then you've got the layer above that. And so people consider that, say, for CO oxidation, that the CO would be activated on the top layer and the oxygen would be activated at the site interfacing with the support matrix. Now, as you go bigger in particles, obviously the morphology of that structure changes, but you still end up with these interfacial sites, which are likely to be key in the catalysis that's observed.
Of course, one thing that occurs to most people when they think of gold is cash, is the value. Is this expensive work to do, or does it actually work out cheaper than doing the same sorts of reactions with existing catalysts?
Gold, of course, is considered to be an expensive metal. It's a bullion metal. It's traded on the world markets and goes up and down with the whims of the markets. And, of course, at the moment, it's very expensive indeed, somewhere between $1,100 and $1,200 per ounce. But in terms of a catalyst, the metal component of the catalyst is not a massive expense. And, of course, platinum and other metals, which are also precious, are used regularly as catalysts. Platinum and palladium, very expensive metals, are used in car exhaust catalysts, and so the general public will all be driving around using precious metal catalysts. A certain amount of the dust at the side of the roads is now considered to contain a measurable amount of platinum metal, and so it might be worth at some point trying to extract it from that source. Although gold could be considered to be expensive, I don't think its price is going to preclude it from being commercially exploited.
And just finally, what do you think the next step will be? What's the next thing that we need to work out?
Well, I think from a theoretical point of view, it would be really nice to nail why it is that gold is capable of doing certain reactions with such great specificity. And so our mechanistic understanding really has to come up to speed. The second bit is really we need to get gold to break into a commercial application. The fact that gold is a really active catalyst for carbon monoxide oxidation gives it possibilities to be commercialized in breathing apparatus, and I know that there are current possibilities of that from a group in China. And one thing which I haven't discussed earlier is that gold, when it's alloyed with other metals, can improve its activity. And so gold alloyed with palladium takes on much higher activities than gold alone for particular applications. So there's a number of ways in which I would hope that gold will be commercialized. Then, of course, once that happens, I think things open up and drives the field much further.
Graham Hutchings explaining how, even though we don't understand how it works, there are lots of opportunities for gold nanoparticles in chemistry, perhaps heralding a nanogold rush. And from nanocatalysts to microjet engines lined with catalase. Matt.
Yes, Ben. So scientists in Dresden have developed microscopic jet engines powered by an enzyme that makes bubbles of oxygen from hydrogen peroxide as a fuel. So these jet engines are made out of alternating thin layers of titanium and gold, which are rolled up into tubes. And on the inside of the tubes, they've attached catalase enzymes. And catalase protects cells in the body from toxic effects of hydrogen peroxide by converting it into oxygen and water. So the catalase inside the tubes makes bubbles of oxygen, which propel the tube along. And as the tube's moving forward, more hydrogen peroxide is being put into the top of the tube, which is then being converted into oxygen, and so the process goes and goes and goes.
So the exhaust gases, the oxygen, are sort of acting like a chimney to pull more fuel in at the top end.
Yeah, that's right. So the interesting thing about these new microengines is that in the past, equivalent engines have been made, but using platinum catalysts instead. Now, these new microengines are 10 times faster than these equivalent platinum-catalyzed microengines. They can also go at the same speed, but only use up one-tenth of the amount of hydrogen peroxide fuel, so they're more efficient. The problem at the moment is that we're still using hydrogen peroxide. The platinum-catalyzed microengines used 10 to 15% hydrogen peroxide as fuel, which is obviously quite strong bleach. These systems are using 1.5% hydrogen peroxide, which is going in the right direction, but it's still toxic. So the team in the future hope to use glucose as a fuel instead of hydrogen peroxide, which is obviously non-toxic, and it's also abundant in biological systems, such as in the body.
We've described them as microscopic jet engines, but how big actually are they?
The tubes are generally around about 25 micrometres long.
So they are really very small, but what use is an engine that's that small? How do we hope to use it, especially if we're talking about using it in a biological context? What do we expect them to do for us?
So the scientists that have developed this technology hope that the microjet engines will be used to power tiny machines that can shunt cargoes. In the future, that could possibly mean that it would be used to take drugs into particular parts of the body as drug delivery.
Thank you very much. And finally for this month, Nina, we've found a way to combine both solar power and a means of storing that power. What's this about?
That's right, Ben. So this team at the University of St Andrews in Scotland have developed a new molecular system that has the potential basis for a battery that can be recharged by light. So light generates a charge, and this system allows it to be stored until needed. In the case of normal photovoltaic cells, the charge rapidly neutralises it, so you have to store it somewhere else or use it immediately. The system used by this team is based on a tree-like organic semiconducting dendrimer molecule with a cyanine-based centre, so this is an aromatic-based centre. This forms the layer between the two electrodes. So the cyanine core absorbs the light and it forms an excited state. And this is the clever bit. In the charged state, the conformation that the isomer forms is really stable and it stays in that form, allowing the charge to be stored until it's needed. So when the battery turned on, the charge moved the electrons and the conformer changes and the system discharges the power. So far, this has just been an exciting proof of principle, and they've only been able to store a very small amount of energy. But the scientists are quite confident they're going to be able to scale it up. They've also been looking at the number of times that you can reuse it, and they've so far managed to do 10 different charge and discharge cycles, and everything still looks fine.
So what's the advantage of packaging this together into one product rather than having a solar panel that we're used to that we can now generate relatively cheap and a battery that we're used to that we can now make fairly cheap? What's the advantage of pulling them together?
It just size. It just means that you'll be able to fit your solar panel system into a much smaller space. So as well as being smaller, because we waste energy when we move it between different systems, the fact that it's all packaged together should mean that we should be able to store energy with more efficiency.
Thanks, Nina. And now it's time to tickle your funny bone with the chemistry joke of the month.
So this month's joke is, what do chemists call a benzene ring with iron atoms replaced in the carbon atoms?
I have no idea. What do chemists call a benzene ring with iron atoms replacing the carbon atoms?
A Ferris wheel.
Ugh, bum bum.
That was an awful joke. On that note, that's our last joke for a while, as we're going to now move into sharing some chemical trivia with you.
So what sort of things do you mean by chemical trivia? What are we looking for people to contribute?
We've got one to kick off, which is, a bucket full of water contains more atoms than there are bucketfuls of water in the Atlantic Ocean.
I see. So really interesting, statistical, quirky stuff, things that you almost can't believe, and that's what you want people to submit. How should they let you know?
Okay, so if you want to share some chemical trivia with us and our listeners, you can email us at chemistryworld@rsc.org.
And you can also use that address if you'd like to send us some feedback about this or any of our previous programmes. That's it for this month's Chemistry World podcast. We'll be back next month with more chemistry news and interviews and the first of your amazing chemical trivia. In the meantime, don't forget to join us for the weekly Chemistry in Its Element podcast. This month's contributors were Nina Notman, Matt Wilkinson and Mike Brown, and production was by me, Ben Valsler, from thenakedscientist.com. So until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.